This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Haitian activists protest a mostly Black college's plans to honor Hillary Clinton. Mumia Abu-Jamal remembers the early days of the MOVE organization, and a distinguished scientist says the Syrians have been unfairly blamed for using chemical weapons, but the corporate media doesn't care about the truth.
But first, a judge has ordered Harris County, Texas, which includes the city of Houston, to stop keeping low-level offenders in jail because they are unable to pay bail. The case was brought by the Washington-based Civil Rights Corps. Executive Director Alex Cara Katsanis says his firm is working to eliminate the bail system entirely.
On any given night in this country, there are about 450,000 human beings who are sitting in a cage, an American jail cell, because they can't come up with a particular amount of money that's been required for their release. And this decision and a number of other decisions in cases that we've brought over the last couple of years, I think are on the road to helping us as a society, as a legal system, as a culture, to eradicating the notion of wealth-based human caging. And so I'm really excited about it. I think this is just one sort of the latest, most, I think, significant development in a longer, broader movement that is resensitizing our society to how brutal it is to put a human being in a cage, and to put a human being in a cage for such a ridiculous reason, like that they don't have enough money to buy their way out. So I'm really encouraged by the decision. I think it's a stunning achievement by the judge. I mean, it's 193 pages long. It has devastating legal and factual detail. And I think it really reveals something that we've been saying for a long time, which is that if you put the American money bail system, this for-profit money bail system, which exists only in the United States and the Philippines, if you put it under any kind of scrutiny, all of the justifications that are offered for the system just utterly collapse.
And what was it about Houston that made it such a bad place to be a defendant and a good place to bring this kind of legal action?
Well, I don't really think there's actually anything particularly special about Houston other than, I mean, obviously, Houston arrests a tremendous number of people. There are about over 50,000 human beings every year in Harris County, Texas, which is where Houston is, arrested for just misdemeanor offenses. Over 70,000 people arrested every year total in Harris County, Texas. But as far as their reliance on money to determine who's in jail and who's not in jail, it's really actually very similar to the way most places around the country do things. And so we've brought cases all over the country. We've brought cases in Georgia, Massachusetts, Chicago, Tennessee, California, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas. So all of Missouri, you know, we have cases in Ferguson raising a lot of the same issues. We brought a big case in New Orleans. So there's nothing really different about the way Houston does things versus the way, say, for example, Nashville or Atlanta do things. It's just that we can't be everywhere at once. And there were some aspects of Harris County's system in Texas that drew us there, namely that it's the third largest jail system in the country and that it has really bad detention rates in low-level cases that we thought made it a particularly good place to start branching out some of our victories that we've had in smaller cities and towns around the country to bigger cities. But no, I mean, there's nothing really special about it. We're also litigating cases in many other cities.
The ruling's not final, but in principle, you believe you made the case.
Yes. I mean, I think often these preliminary injunction hearings are supposed to be sort of abbreviated proceedings. Points of a preliminary injunction, and they're very, very hard to get. The plaintiffs have to show not only that they're likely to win the case at the end, but also that if a ruling temporarily protecting them isn't issued, they're going to suffer irreparable harm while the rest of the case is litigated. So really, the point of a preliminary injunction is to say, what's happening is wrong and so likely to hurt you while this case goes forward, because, you know, cases can take a long time, that as a preliminary matter, the judge is going to order the other side to stop doing this thing while you fight about it in court. But in this particular case, we did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of briefing, multiple in-person arguments for 10 months or so prior to litigating the preliminary injunction. And then we had an 8-day full-on hearing with five really expert witnesses, judges testifying, prosecutors testifying, all kinds of other witnesses. And we had hundreds of thousands of documents and records. We had thousands of videos of bail hearings. It was a really robust presentation. And so it looked a lot like what a final trial would look like. And so it is technically a preliminary ruling, but the judge's ruling is, as a result, so robust that we think that it certainly won't change later in the case.
If you ultimately prevail in this case, does that mean that you won't have to go through all the same steps you did in Houston when confronting the bail systems in other cities across the country?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we're hoping, as always, that other places around the country will, on their own, sort of voluntarily make reforms that are obviously in the best interest of their residents and that save them a lot of money and that reduce the level of brutality that we're finding in the American jail system. So, for example, you know, we filed a case on Jackson, Mississippi, where they were locking up people for not being able to pay their traffic tickets, very similar to our cases in Ferguson and Jennings, Missouri, which is the town next to Ferguson, where we won cases, and Montgomery, Alabama. And in Jackson, Mississippi, and in Montgomery, Alabama, and likewise in Ferguson, even though we sued them over jailing people for tickets, all three cities decided to also end their reliance on money bail in misdemeanor cases. And so those are big decisions. And we're hoping that more and more places will start doing that on their own voluntarily and not have to wait for us to be sued. Those cities and counties that want to fight in court, I think this Houston decision will really help us make our case that there really is no justification, either legal or factual, for maintaining a money-based system about who's in jail and who's not in jail.
You said that the United States and the Philippines are the only two such systems in the world. Would it be fair to characterize this system with bail at the heart as pay-for-play justice?
Yeah, so I mean, the American money bail system is devastating to low-income people, people of color, their families, their communities, and to everyone who perpetrates this violence on them through our acquiescence in our legal and political institutions. And so it's terrible for taxpayers, it's terrible for all of us who want to be part of a community that values justice. And the only group that benefits from the existing American money bail system is the for-profit multi-billion-dollar bail industry. So they have, for many, many years, prevented significant reforms from happening. But I think now there's been such a sea change in the way that everybody thinks about this system that I think they're going to be hard-pressed to put a stop to it.
Well, the people who build prisons and, of course, correctional officers get their jobs from large, bulging jails. How big would the Houston jail be if it were not for high bail?
Well, so it's important to say that our Harris County case right now only dealt with misdemeanor offenses. And so that misdemeanors account for about 50,000 of the 75,000 arrests every year in Harris County. But because misdemeanor cases get processed more quickly, on any given day, misdemeanor inmates are only about 6 or 7% of the Harris County jail. So they're cycling through. Many, many more people spend time in jail on misdemeanors, but usually it's only 3 or 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 12, 15 days, right? It's not 5, 6, 10, 12 months, like in some felony cases. But I will say that about 3/4 of Harris County's jail population on any given day is there on money bail they can't afford. These are presumptively innocent people who have not been convicted yet. So if we're able to eradicate this wealth-based system, it'll significantly reduce local jail populations all over the country. And because, and this is another important point that the judge made in her decision in Harris County, we know that money bail leads to additional convictions because it coerces people to plead guilty just to get out of jail. So we know that fixing the American money bail system will also dramatically reduce the number of people that end up in prison.
Now, this decision only deals with people who have been charged with low-level crimes.
That's right. This decision right now only deals with misdemeanor offenses.
But there is no principle in law that says that you shouldn't scale that up to all offenses.
No, that's correct. The equal protection and due process principles apply equally and to felonies and to misdemeanors. And for what it's worth, the police and prosecutors around the country have argued that money bail makes even less sense in the context of more serious crimes, because while many of us are really concerned with the money bail system because it leads to a lot of low-income people being trapped in jail, many police and prosecutors, including many federal prosecutors and federal judges, have commented that the other problem with money bail is it allows people to be released no matter how dangerous and serious their crime is if they're rich. So, you know, the example that's often given is that the money bail system allows someone like Robert Durst to walk free, but someone like Sandra Bland to be stuck in jail. And so I think, if anything, the justifications for eradicating the American money bail system will be more powerful to a lot of people in more serious cases than they are with misdemeanors.
Well, what institutional forces would resist this then? Who has the biggest interest in maintaining the system as it is?
I think it's the American bail industry and the sort of offshore corporations, that insurance corporations and conglomerates that sort of underwrite a lot of the bail insurance contracts. Then there's just a tremendous amount of inertia in changing the criminal legal system. The system has developed to become an extremely effective bureaucracy, and it's always very, very difficult to dismantle bureaucracies, particularly bureaucracies that are important for asserting certain forms of economic and racial control. And so, like many of the systems that this country has relied on to exert that kind of control, reducing the size of any aspect of the American criminal system has a lot of stakeholders, some of which are obvious and others of which are a little bit less obvious, but powerful. And so I don't want to make it sound like it'll be easy. I mean, certainly we're fighting a significant battle. And one thing that we have on our side is I think growing awareness from ordinary people and growing cultural consciousness that the American criminal system has not been pursuing goals like flourishing communities and public safety, but in fact has been pursuing exactly the opposite, devastating certain communities, controlling certain communities, policing, criminalizing, and punishing certain communities. And that same narrative is really forcefully played out in the bail system.
Yes, mass black incarceration has always been about more than just direct extraction of profits from prisoners.
Oh, of course. I mean, in fact, incredible level of profit seeking directly as a relatively recent phenomenon. And mass incarceration was well underway before any of that stuff became really unhinged. And if you look at like the actual amount of direct profits, it's relatively low compared to some of the other consequences economically for a lot of these communities. So it's tough to explain, I think impossible to explain, the rise of mass incarceration, particularly incarceration of people of color, just purely based on this theory that, oh, well, someone's making money off of it. It's serving very, very particular and other distinct important social functions and economic functions generally that don't involve just looking at some company's balance sheet.
So we can expect that those forces will also come out of the woodwork and show themselves in this challenge to bail.
I think so, yes. I think any social justice challenge that has the potential to dramatically alter the way that our society looks will have a lot of resistance from forces that benefit from the way our society currently looks.
That was Alec Karakatsanis of the Civil Rights Corps, speaking from Washington.
Haitian activists in Brooklyn, New York, are vowing to prevent Hillary Clinton from giving the commencement speech at mostly black Medgar Evers College next month. Daoud Andre is with Komokota, the committee to mobilize against dictatorship in Haiti.
We found out about this invitation to have Hillary speak, be the commencement speaker for the 2017 Medgaeva's college graduating class in an article in the New York Times that came out on April 7th. And the funny thing is that Rudy Crewe, who has quite a notorious past as a former chancellor for the Board of Education, Department of Education here in New York City under Rudolph Giuliani, who was carrying water for Giuliani before Giuliani fired him. He's the current president of Medgaeva's College. In this article, the man says that Hillary Clinton is not only a paragon of virtue, but the greatest woman leader he could imagine to be speaking to the students today. So we were offended. We were offended in every kind of way you can imagine as Colo-Coda, the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti, who spent years informing, educating people in New York, all over the country, the world, about the crimes of the Clinton family and Hillary Clinton personally against the people of Haiti, against black youth who she called animals, dogs, who should be brought to heel. And at another level, Medgaeva was who? This was a black man, civil rights leader, who fought for the rights of black people and was killed because of this at a time when Hillary was not standing for civil rights, which we understand she later did. But at a personal level, my son goes to Medgaeva College in Brooklyn. This is Medgaeva College is in Crown Heights. This is the heart of the black community in Brooklyn, in black Brooklyn, the heart of the Caribbean community in Brooklyn. So we could not allow this. We will not allow this to happen. So on Tuesday, the 2nd of May, we held a press conference in front of Medgaeva College to demand that Rudy Crewe, that the administration of Medgaeva College, that the CUNY chancellor, James Milliken, that they rescind this invitation and to demand to stop Medgaeva from awarding this honorary degree to this criminal, this racist, this woman who, as Secretary of State, supported military coups and assassinations of foreign leaders, who herself, her husband, their foundation are responsible for billions of dollars earthquake reconstruction money that was stolen from the people of Haiti, for mass incarceration of black youth, the same black youth who make up the majority of the students at Medgaeva College. We are happy that we had a lot of support from the African-American community, Caribbean community at the press conference. Ralph Poynter, Lynn Stewart's husband, a member of the New Abolitionist Movement, spoke, a longtime activist in the black community. We had attorney Roger Wareham from the December 12th movement who spoke. We had a very strong statement from Charles Barron, Assemblyman Charles Barron. We had two students who are graduating at Medgaeva College, who's also a member of Kumukoda, who spoke. And my son, Amadou, who's, like I said, a student at Medgaeva College, he spoke as well at this press conference. So for many students, faculty, staff who were passing by and getting our flyers, we gave out hundreds of flyers, this is the first they heard of this. And they were appalled, and they stood with us, chanted with us, "Shame on you, Rudy Crewe." And this will not happen. We will not allow this to happen. We are on that level. We are happy that our sister Utrice Lead also, who does the Lead Stories radio program on PRN, Progressive Radio Network, has embraced this cause and is calling on the community to stop this, to make sure that this does not go down. The first step we think people listening to this program can do is to call Rudy Crewe's office at 718-270-5000. That's 718 270-5000. They should also call the CUNY Chancellor, James Milliken is his name, at 646-664-9100, 646-664-9100, and tell them that our community will not stand for this, that Hillary Clinton is someone who belongs in the dustbin of history. You know, we really thought that after this election, you know, she would dig a hole and stay in there. There was a funny article, a quote by David Axelrod, who was in Obama's campaign, and he said, it takes a lot of work to lose to Donald Trump. And that has been our position, that Hillary Clinton was the only person who could have made something as odious as Donald Trump president of the United States. So we are asking the community to join with us in not allowing the memory, the legacy of Medgar Evers to be sullied by this attempt at resurrecting this cadaver, Hillary Clinton.
Well, one of the people who was not supportive of your demonstration was Yvette Clark. She's the black congresswoman who represents that district.
Well, what can we say about Yvette? Black Agenda does a lot of work on the black misleadership class. And Yvette Clark is of that ilk. We reminded people at that event that every time the Clintons get in a bind, it is to the black community that they run to whitewash their image. Folks should remember that after getting impeached for lying under oath in Monica Lewinsky business, Bill Clinton brought Jesse Jackson and a host of black preachers to the White House to pray with him. When you had this deleted emails business that had just come out a couple of years ago, what did Hillary Clinton do? You know, she had Bill de Blasio's wife, a black woman, Charlene McRae, bring her to Brownsville in Brooklyn. This is one of the most impoverished black neighborhoods in Brooklyn, for her to have photo ops with little black children, as if she cares about these little black children. Folks should remember that Hillary Clinton was senator from New York, a carpetbagger senator, but senator nonetheless for two terms in Washington, you know? And I don't think she ever went to Brownsville. And people should ask her, what did she do as senator to improve the conditions for these children, to eliminate the reality that most of these children, this is the few zip codes that have the most people in these jails that her and her husband are responsible for building. And, you know, there was a point in Hillary's campaign when she had set and reset and nothing seemed to be moving. It was David Dinkins, another black Uncle Tom, who brought her to Columbia University for this thing he does that's called the Dinkins Leadership and Public Policy Forum. So we are not at all surprised that people like Yvette Clark would continue to be trying to prop up this thing called Hillary Clinton that for us is a cadaver. And in our culture, they say that in voodoo, that people can bring the dead back to life as zombies. But what we'd like to tell them, tell these people who are trying to resurrect Hillary Clinton, that sometimes you go to try and bring back the dead and you are the one who ends up dying yourself. So they should really beware.
Of course, Brooklyn has the greatest concentration of Haitians outside of Haiti itself. And Hillary Clinton and her husband have many vested interests in Haiti, and many Haitians have a vested interest in her relinquishing those interests.
Well, you know that after the election, very quietly, you know, the Clinton Foundation sort of publicly pulled out of their operations in Haiti. Supposedly, passing it on to other corrupt but lesser profile NGOs. And it's funny because after this action at Medgar Evers, there is an article which came out in a publication called The Kings County Politics. And they got comment from the Clinton Foundation saying that these are lies, that the Clintons have worked so hard to help Haiti and beyond the call of duty, and that they did not really steal this money. What we would really love, because we've been calling them thieves for years now, and we've been waiting for them to bring us to court, for them to send something to Komokota to cease and desist from calling them liars and thieves and crooks, which they are. And we really hope that this lawsuit for libel or whatever, that the Clintons would bring it so that we can ask them for what happened to these billions of dollars that they stole from the Haitian people, to speak about these billions from USAID that went to their cronies, you know, no-bid contracts, to build these sweatshop factories that they swore would create 60,000 jobs in 5 years. And we are more than 5 years later right now, and these sweatshops, they barely have like 3,000 people working, like I said, at the sweatshop wages. So these are not favors that the Clintons have done for the people of Haiti. And you see, there are these people over here who continue to think that they can defend Hillary Clinton. There is nothing defensible that you can defend about Hillary Clinton from any perspective. She's not a feminist. She doesn't care about women. I mean, stories abound over here about what she did to the women that Bill Clinton abused. Some of them say he raped them, and then she persecuted them afterwards. And the women, poor women in Haiti, that she is responsible for these slave wages, something like 40 cents an hour. They're not women. So the people who call themselves progressives, who still insist on propping up, we call her dead horse. What is progressive about the policies of pushing coups, pushing the toppling of governments, the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, the coup in Honduras? This is like Hillary Clinton, pure Hillary Clinton. So we think that there is necessity for movements to really coalesce and stop a lot of the garbage that's coming from Trump. But by hanging on to Hillary Clinton as something that they are trying, for reasons we can't imagine, to salvage, a lot of folks who call themselves progressives, they must understand that they are doing the movement, their movement, you know, a disfavor, because many of us will never join with them so long as they think that they can stand with this family.
Well, Hillary Clinton has the biggest money-raising operation in the Democratic Party. She certainly proved that, even though she lost the bid for presidency. I suppose that counts among folks like Yvette Clark and others.
Yeah, definitely that's what it is. And besides the money, you should know, Glenn, that these lackeys, they're scared. They are afraid of the Clinton machine, you know? They understand that when time comes for their reelection or for them to get their little pet projects, that the Clintons, who are still running behind the scenes, of course, the Democratic Party, can stop them, you know, can support alternate candidates. So they remain like lapdogs to the Clintons, to do the dirty work of the Clintons. But we will block them, we will mobilize against them. And this thing for June 8th, this graduation, we are very happy. I should also mention the organization United African Movement here in Brooklyn that has come on board, wants to get involved very seriously in making sure that this does not happen. And I think that Medgar Evers College will have no choice but to stop this. But beyond that, it will be a message to these crony, this Black Miss Leadership class, that there is no life for them standing with the Clintons, with Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton once famously said that Black super predator criminals must be brought to heel, but she certainly has brought the political Black class to heel.
Absolutely, and this is exactly what we're talking about. They want the Clinton money. They are afraid of them because people usually speak of the vengeance from the Clintons if you cross them. But what we communities of color need to show these people that there is more to lose when they betray their communities to please the crooks and criminals like the Clintons.
That was Daoud Andre speaking from Brooklyn, New York.
The Trump administration continues to insist, without any convincing evidence, that the Syrian military is responsible for a chemical weapons attack in Idlib province last month. The U.S. bombed a Syrian military base supposedly in retaliation for the chemical attack. But Theodore Postol, a professor emeritus of science, technology, and national security issues at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, debunked the allegation against Syria, showing the attack could not have happened the way the U.S. said it did. However, the American corporate media completely ignored Professor Postol's findings. He says the press no longer care about the truth.
Well, I think it's a pretty sad situation with the mainstream media. I mean, the facts don't seem to matter at all to anybody. It's really unfortunate. You know, the evidence so far indicates that the White House report of April 11, which alleges the location of the sarin release, is based on data that you can verify has nothing to do with a sarin release, at least of the kind that they claim. And just recently, I'm finishing up a document on this Human Rights Watch report that came out on May 1, and they actually asserted that they know what the munition used might have been. And the forensic evidence from that munition would be unrecognizably different from what they show. So it's just like, the answer is the Syrian government executed a nerve agent attack, and now what's your question? I find it disturbing because I'm a person who, over many years, has a high regard for journalism and how it's been done, and I just see that it looks to me like a complete collapse of any kind of journalistic standards within the mainstream press. It's just hard to believe.
Yes, the people who should be going around looking for sources and verifying seem to have become stenographers.
It's an unfortunate situation because the press is the engine for a democratic society. If you don't have people, if the population, if the electorate doesn't have an independent source of information that it can then use to make judgments, then it only has the government. And what the press is doing is simply repeating without any kind of critical thought what the government has said. And the government says something and it's right, so be it. But they should be concerned about all the contradictory evidence that's out there, that all they have to do is look at it.
The press performed much of the same function back in 2013 when the Syrians were charged similarly with a chemical weapon assault.
Right. Of course, in 2013, there were very big questions right from the beginning. And in fact, I think the New York Times was publishing first page articles that were absolutely wrong. And they inadvertently, I guess, published an article about work that I had done with my colleague Dick Lloyd, because the finding sort of supported their narrative. And then when we found completely additional information that did not support their narrative, they weren't interested. It was really clear and unambiguous that the only news they were interested in, the only factual news they were interested in, was news that supported their narrative. It's really so blatant, even I was taken aback by it.
So the New York Times has been selective even when quoting your evidence.
Yep, that's true too.
Strikes against Syria, like the one that was supposedly in retaliation for the chemical event earlier, certainly bring the world closer to nuclear war. But you and others are saying that the United States' nuclear configuration and technological advances in weaponry have themselves made nuclear war thinkable to Pentagon planners.
Well, I think, fortunately, Pentagon planners are not the only people involved in decision-making. But I think certainly actions taken in the modernization program, the nuclear weapons modernization program, certainly create the appearance to any analyst, particularly Russian military analysts, that the United States wants to have an option to fight and win a nuclear war against Russia. And that's got to cause people to be very nervous and to take steps that are probably in nobody's interest, because they don't want to be put in a position where it looks like the United States could succeed in doing that. And so they're taking steps that are aimed at making it more difficult for us to conclude that we can do that. But at the same time, it's all their steps are also problematic in terms of creating instabilities that everybody will suffer from.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have recently released a paper saying that the United States has already reached a tipping point technologically in which it believes that it can knock out virtually all of Russia's silo-based missiles and still have 80% of the U.S. arsenal left over for a second strike.
Yeah, or third strikes or fourth strikes. Yeah, of course, they could not hope to get enough weapons that the United States wouldn't be destroyed in a retaliation. But I think it's the appearance that the United States is trying to gain, you know, sort of a nuclear dominance that is really pushing the situation in a bad way. So, for example, missile defense activities of the United States create the appearance, when it's looked at in an integrated way, when U.S. programs are looked at in an integrated way, it creates the appearance that the United States wants an option to destroy a very large part of Russian forces, essentially everything that's in a fixed location, and then would use its defenses to deal with the ragged retaliation that would follow, and or that could follow, that would likely follow. So this makes it, you know, these missile defense activities create the appearance that the United States is trying to build a strike and defensive capability that could allow it to win an overall nuclear war. Now, in reality, of course, none of those capabilities would work, well, certainly work well enough to cause the United States to escape destruction. But the appearance of striving to do this does cause concern among the political leadership of other countries, and in particular in Russia. And they are taking measures. I don't say they will. They are taking measures to offset any chance of even appearing that, like, these activities could result in something that would result in real superiority. And those actions are not necessarily in anyone's interest. For example, this underwater unmanned vehicle that Putin was showing that could travel thousands of kilometers as a robot and carry an enormous warhead that would be unaffected, of course, by either an American first strike or missile defenses. But that's not an accident that he showed this weapon system. He's saying you're not going to escape no matter what you try to do. But that's not a weapon that you really would like to see proliferate. But if the United States forces Russian leadership to consider doing this kind of thing, well, you know, it has an adverse effect on everyone.
Yes, throughout the entire nuclear era, the Russians, including the Soviet Russians, always had a no-first-strike policy until recent years, when they believed that the United States was aiming for a first strike of its own.
I would say what the United States claims it wants to do. First of all, I don't think the United States knows what it wants to do. I don't think it's that simple. I think people in different parts of the government think different things, and of course, political leadership changes, and who knows what political leadership thinks at a given time, even if you're not talking about potentially unstable president. But I don't think most political leaders, in fact, I don't think I've met any political leaders who think that you could who I believe when you get them in private and they're not posturing, thinks that you can fight and win a nuclear war. And that's very important because these are the people who ultimately could make a decision that would be catastrophic. So I think the bottom line is they don't necessarily understand the details, but they have a view, which I think is correct, that if you try to win, you will lose in the end. Everyone will lose in the end. So that's good. That's a stabilizing factor. But the activities on both sides that create the appearance that each one wants to maintain an option to do something that would be in the form of a first strike is very, very dangerous. I don't think the Russians are now postured in a way where they can credibly think that they have a first strike capability. And I don't think, from what I know of Russian thinking on this subject, through personal contacts with people at the highest levels of the Russian military, that I don't think anybody I've met thinks that this is a good policy or it could in any way be practical for the Russians to adopt such a policy, and that's good. But they do want to make sure that the United States fully appreciates that an attack on Russia would be suicide.
That was Professor Theodore Postol of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, shares a long history with the MOVE organization, which was also savagely targeted by the Philadelphia police, and many of whose members are also serving long terms in the Pennsylvania prison system. MOVE last week held a conference in Philadelphia, marking its 45th anniversary. MOVE Minister of Communications, Ramona Africa, asked Mumia to recollect his memories of MOVE in the old days.
On the MOVE, y'all, Sister Mona asked that I speak on two issues, Rochester, New York, and the John Africa trial. So what Mona wants, Mona gets, right? It was spring 1981 when MOVE members got busted on federal charges stemming from the MOVE confrontation of August 8, 1978, Philadelphia. MOVE supporter Abdul John and I talked to editors of the Philadelphia Tribune, and both of us were sent to cover the story. I, the writer, he, the photographer. Coming from Philadelphia, we didn't know what to expect when we got to this northern New York City. If memory serves, the main MOVE house was on Flint Street, in the heart of a neat, middle-class, and working-class black community. Remember all the hubbub about MOVE folks and their neighbors in West Philly? None of this existed in Rochester. None of it. Here, MOVE members did exactly as they did in Philadelphia. They lived together as a commune. They worked at jobs. They ran around the block, and so on. Some men cut their hair, and many changed their names, but that was just sensible, right? When Abdul and I interviewed neighbors, we were shocked that they had never heard of MOVE nor John Africa. One neighbor, an elderly man, learning that his neighbor, Bill, got arrested, almost shed tears, for he said Bill took care of his dog and he himself when he was hungry, for Bill brought him food to eat. Bill was John Africa. MOVE members, living underground in Rochester, lived a life of peace that was unthinkable in Philadelphia. I wondered why. Then it dawned on me. They lived out of the eye of a merciless media. Absent the zone of negativity by the media, people met MOVE as people and loved them. I learned a lot about the media in Rochester, New York. The trial. MOVE members made leaflets calling the trial against Vinny and Mo Africa, John Africa versus the system. It looked like this was a trial that the system was bound to win. The trial in federal court featured U.S. Marshals rolling a large wooden dolly into the courtroom every morning, where the barrels of a half dozen rifles could be seen, as well as several gallon-sized milk containers filled with black powder and explosives, or so they said, every day. John Africa ordered his lawyers to not object to anything. Mo Africa conducted the examination of witnesses. And John Africa leaned back in his chair and slept through much of the trial. He awoke to give a booming closing argument that explained some of Move's beliefs, but also denied that Move believed in bombs. But the system did. It's been 30 years, so I can't remember how long he spoke. An hour? 2 hours? 2.5 hours? Didn't matter. I expected guilty for both guys. Guilty, guilty, guilty. And 30 or 40 or 50 year sentences. When the jury came back several days later and acquitted both men, I was dumbfounded. So were the prosecutors. So was everybody, except perhaps John Africa. From Imprisoned Nation, this is your brother, Mumia Abu Jamal. Long live John Africa.
Mumia Abu Jamal, the former head of New York City's Police Reform Organizing Project, Robert Ganji, is running for mayor on a broadly progressive platform. Incumbent Mayor Bill de Blasio still has some people convinced that he is a progressive. But Robert Ganji says there's nothing progressive at all about de Blasio.
That is a success that de Blasio has had, is presenting himself as a true progressive and a liberal. And most of the mainstream press continues to identify him as the progressive mayor of New York City. But his actions have not earned him that status. He has, across a whole range of issues, not followed through on his campaign promise when he first ran for mayor in 2013 to rewrite the Tale of Two Cities narrative that tears at the fabric of our city to address the social, racial, and economic inequities that do such great harm to large populations who live in our city. Vulnerable groups, low-income African-Americans and Latinos, street vendors, homeless people, mentally ill people, sex workers. So I voted for him in 2013, and I had high hopes, and I think a lot of New Yorkers did. Obviously, he won in a virtual landslide. But I know there are a lot of New Yorkers, in turn, including myself, who've been very disappointed. And one of the things that we're concerned about is not only that he's not helping make New York a more just city, a more inclusive city in any significant way, but that the pretense, what is a baseless claim that he's progressive, gives our kind of politics a bad name. So he's a progressive, but he supports broken windows policing. That's blatantly racist policing, that deeply inhumane policing that puts immigrant New Yorkers at risk of deportation. His affordable housing plan that he and his people brag about, upon examination, you realize that most of the units being built under this plan are not truly affordable. They're not affordable in vast numbers for the people who live in the communities where the housing is being constructed. Again, claims to be a progressive, but there's a very well-organized citywide campaign to promote reduced fare for low-income people in our subways and buses. Our campaign is promoting free fare for low-income people. De Blasio refuses to support reduced fare. Instead, his police department, which he controls, devotes a lot of its resources to arresting and giving summonses to people who attempt to sneak onto the subway. And we know people don't jump turnstiles for the thrill of it. They attempt to sneak onto the subway because the cost of the subway is a financial burden for them. And what the city should be doing, particularly under a progressive mayor, is helping poor people be able to use mass transit in the city so they can get to jobs and to school and to job interviews and to health care providers instead of criminalizing them, which is what the de Blasio policies effectively do. On homelessness, he has sent the flag of surrender up the pole. He's no longer talking about that the fundamental approach to homelessness should be to provide homes and affordable housing. He's now planning to build 90 more shelters in different parts of the city and promises that after 5 years, the homeless population would have been reduced by only 2,500 people. And we have a homeless population in the city over 60,000 people. And that's probably a conservative number. So no particular plan to improve the public schools in a way that's going to be meaningful
for particularly the students from disadvantaged communities who use our public schools. So he's not an honest progressive. He's not addressing the social, racial, and economic injustices that are a blight on our city. And we're running a campaign that pledges to address those inequities, and we have specific substantive plans. We're not just engaged in rhetoric and soundbites, although we do engage in rhetoric and soundbites. We have specific substantive plans to substantiate our pledges.
Now, you don't have a history of running for office, and your plate was full as head of the police reform organizing project. You must have looked around and wondered why nobody else is challenging de Blasio.
Yeah, the conclusion that we came to wasn't just me who made the decision. It was a number of people around me who worked with me at Prop, who worked with me at positions I held before, and my family and some close friends. What we saw is that de Blasio was going to skate into being reelected. No mainstream politician with a lot of name recognition in the city was going to challenge him. And if they had, they wouldn't be raising the issues and presenting the solutions that our campaign does either. So we knew our candidacy, my candidacy was going to be that we were going to be underdogs. And we wanted to take advantage that an election year provides to engage in a meaningful way in a public debate about the issues, particularly, again, issues that fall under the heading of social, racial, or economic injustices. And we wanted to put forward proposals that a lot of the public hasn't heard before and to, in effect, put those proposals on more and more of the radar screen of the media and of the public. So that was our intention, recognizing again that we're underdogs and we still think we have a chance to win. De Blasio is not his popularity to the extent that there is popularity. He doesn't run very deep. And there are a lot of people who share the criticisms that we're making.
That was Robert Ganji campaigning for mayor of New York.
The mothers of victims of police violence and intra-community crime will gather for a free Mother's Day event at Hostess College in the Bronx section of New York on Saturday. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Juanita Young, whose son was killed by New York City cops. Her group is called The Motherhood.
The fact that so many mothers are facing their loved ones being murdered or taken away, that's a problem. And no one really seems to help us in such a bad time. Like, for example, my son was murdered by the police. You got people's sons who've been murdered through gang violence or gun violence. You got now these young men that's being locked up in these jails with these police raids. What is going on that the system feels that our loved ones' lives have no value, that you just come in and snatch their lives like that? So as a mother, we are asking the mothers to stand united with all mothers and everyone else who can build some kind of support for these mothers to come out. At this free Mother's Day, we're not going to dwell on the pain of what's going on. We're going to celebrate the life of the person that has been affected by this. For example, I would celebrate the memory of my son's Malcolm Knight, what it meant to me and his sister and brother, the person that he was. So that's what we are going to try to do at this Mother's Day event, that celebrate the memory of the person that has been affected.
Now, you spoke at the most recent CCOP, Community Control Over the Police, open house conference in Midtown. What is the importance of community control and being able to, through community, support one another, particularly around this question of police terror and violence against our communities?
The fact that these police officers seem to come in to our neighborhood and either murder or abuse our loved ones, I feel if a police officer lived in the community where he worked, he wouldn't have such a quick hand with that trigger. he wouldn't have such a quick hand in knocking out another individual. But because they're able to come into our community, do what they do and leave, that's a big problem. We don't have to live with this. No, but then if we change it, if we could change it and say, you do have to live with it. Know the people that you are supposed to be protecting. Know the people that really need some help. Then you might see a different and better community. Instead of you coming in, killing a mentally ill woman, and you knew this woman was mentally ill, but you felt her like at no time. You come in and you kill a mother. You go into a community, invade somebody's apartment, claiming you had the wrong apartment, but yet you cause this woman to have a heart attack and die. There's a problem with that. Or you run up in somebody's house and shoot them down while they're in the bathroom. Come on. If you lived in a community, you would know what the people who you had to go to their house, you would know what you're dealing with. You wouldn't be so quick to run up in somebody's house and say, oh, I thought they had a gun, or I saw a weapon. No, you need to be more familiar with the people in the area where you work. So that's why we're going for the police to be living in the communities where they work.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.